Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here again today. This is episode number 438, and in just a moment, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with my recurring guest, Barbara Carnes. And if you're familiar with our previous episodes, you'll know Barbara and I always have a great time talking with each other. Today, we're talking about how to choose a hospice for your loved one. And you'll get to hear from old-fashioned Barbara and old-fashioned Karen as we discuss some of the things that we really appreciated in the past about being part of hospice and that we wish were still true today. So I think you'll enjoy that conversation. I have a few announcements before that, though, that I'd like to cover. One is, remember a couple weeks ago, I shared with you an interview with Kim Clevenger. This was just a little excerpt with Kim Clevenger, who is a casting director looking for participants for a new docu-series on grief. They're looking for people who are grieving any type of loss, who are willing to share their grief and their story publicly with other people, but also participate in a group where they will receive lots of tools and counseling and wisdom from many different experts in the field and willing to be televised publicly. So Kim and I did a little conversation about this show and what they're looking for. You can find that on the podcast or on YouTube. It's called Casting Call on YouTube. If you're interested, you can write to Kim Clevenger for more information at griefshowcasting.com. That's the email address where you can find out a little bit more information about potentially being part of that docuseries. I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be helpful to lots of different people. So if you're willing to share your own journey, I hope you'll give Kim a call and sign up for that. Other announcements, at the end of this month on January 30th, I'm hosting Francesca Arnoldi. She's going to be doing a workshop on her book, The Death Doula's Guide to Living Fully and Dying Prepared. We're offering this to people in the reading group, A Year of Reading Dangerously, but I decided to open it up to everyone. So even if you haven't read Francesca's book yet, I think you'll enjoy it. January 30th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, there will be a registration link in the show notes for this episode. If you go to eolupodcast.com, you'll find the registration link. There's no charge, and the only reason to register is so I can send you the link to listen and also a recording afterwards in case you miss it. And next, I wanted to let you know, I have created some gift guides, and I already know what you're saying, like, what gift guides? I could have used those a month or two ago when I was getting ready for the winter holidays. I know I meant to have them ready in time for Christmas, but because I was in grandma mode at the time, I just didn't get them done, but they're done now. And you know what? There are lots of times when we need to buy gifts for people. So these guides are specifically gifts for caregivers, gifts for people receiving care, and gifts for people who are grieving. There are three different guides with lots of different suggestions of helpful gifts. So if you need a birthday or anniversary gift or a holiday gift for anyone in those categories, you can go to my gift guides at eoluniversity.com/gift-guides. And there will also be a link in the show notes if you want to look over the gift guides and see if there's some, maybe you'll get some inspiration or ideas from the things that I've listed there on those pages. And lastly, I just want to thank my newest supporters on Patreon, Deborah Laukaitis, and Buying Me a Coffee, Dana Tuttle. Thank you so much for your support. I really appreciate everyone who's been making donations and helping me keep this show and the YouTube channel on the air. So we'll move on now with my conversation with Barbara Carnes. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy once again to welcome back my friend, Barbara Carnes, who's been a regular guest on the podcast for, gosh, it's over a year now, at least a year and a half or so, Barbara, that you've been coming on with me. I'm always so happy to have you back again. So welcome.
Well, thank you so much. You know, we're friends now. We have to now eventually see each other in person, but this is really, I look forward to our visits.
Yeah, same here. And I'll just tell people a little bit about you in case anyone by now doesn't know who you are. But Barbara Carnes is a hospice nurse who is internationally recognized as an author, speaker, thought leader, and expert on end-of-life care and the dynamics of dying. Barbara is the author of The Little Blue Book, which you will have heard of if you work in hospice, titled Gone From My Sight. And her newest book is By Your Side, A Guide to Caring for the Dying at Home. And it's a wonderful resource for caregivers, and I highly recommend By Your Side, though all of Barbara's books are really wonderful. And you can learn more at her website, bkbooks.com. So, well, here we are, Barbara, time for another conversation.
It is, and I'm looking forward to our topic today. I think it's going to be very helpful, but also important for people to really understand this experience that they will be having.
And I know you and I both have a lot of experience in hospice, even starting back in the old days. I say when hospice was a little different back then than it is right now. But from our previous conversations, it's clear that both of us feel like having the chance to care for a loved one at home with the help of hospice is really a wonderful opportunity for people. And I think we both really care that people know about hospice and understand how it works and what it can do for them so that they'll take this opportunity and be with their loved ones at home.
You know, if you ask most people, where would you like to die? Most people will say, I want to be home in my bed with the dog on the bed and family there. Hospice allows that to happen because grandma used to live at home in the 50s and 40s and died at home, and we knew what to do because it was handed down. But now grandma is either in the hospital or a nursing facility when she really wants to be at home. And so with a little help and some guidance, which is what hospice does, you can grant that wish and have that sacred experience.
Yes. And it's a wonderful, beautiful experience. It's hard. It's challenging. And I don't want to ever give anyone the impression that it's an easy thing to do, but it will end up, I think, for by and large, most people say it's the best thing they ever did was bringing on hospice, taking their loved one home and providing that care.
It can really be a gift that you'll carry with you for the rest of your life. But I think the important point is that you need support and help and guidance because people don't die like they do in the movies. And you need to understand what's happening, why it's happening, and what do you do while it's happening? And that's hospice.
Yeah. And I can really say in all my years of being associated with hospice, I really have only heard maybe a handful of complaints about hospice. By and large, people are so grateful and have such positive things to say about the hospice and the staff they worked with. But when there have been complaints, it seems to me the problem sometimes is that people chose the wrong hospice or maybe didn't know what they were getting into or what to look for when they were signing on with a hospice. Have you had that experience as well?
I have. And what I think about that is if you were going to buy a new pair of shoes, you would go and try on those shoes before you bought them. If you were going to buy a new car, you would go look at all different kinds of cars and drive them before you bought a car. And yet with our healthcare, whether it's doctors or hospices or home health care agencies, we take what we're given with the idea of we're going to be fine. And there are different hospices, just like there are different hospitals and different home health care agencies. And so shop, you know, before you have an emergency, start making, first Google what hospices are in your area. Mm-hmm. You know, find out how many you've got and talk to every single one of them. Have your list of questions, what you want to know, and talk to them. And then you can select one.
Yeah, and I think there may be some confusion because Medicare-certified hospices, we know, all have certain requirements that they have to live up to in order to be Medicare-certified, which some people might think that means, well, that they should all be similar. The care they offer should be similar. They should all be doing the same things. And there's a certain amount of services that are the same for each hospice. However, the way they're provided and offered can differ a lot. And it's so important that people understand that.
It really is. And just think of physicians have gone to medical school, but their personality and how they approach life and work is different because each person is individual. Well, so it is with the agencies. They've got their guidelines, but what do they do beyond the guidelines? You know, what do they do beyond what they have to do? And I think that's where you're shopping.
Exactly. And just knowing in advance, not all hospices are the same. And particularly right now, we've seen this increase in for-profit, private equity-owned hospices, and things have changed in the type of care that's being offered. So it's really important for consumers out there who are making choices to be aware that there are some hospices where they will get better care than others. And just know that. And as you've said, do your homework.
Well, and I want to clarify, just because they're not for profit doesn't mean they're a great hospice. Just because they are for profit doesn't mean they're a great hospice. It's you want to get inside and ask the questions so that you can determine what's the hospice for you.
So let's dive into it a little bit, Barbara. And what recommendations do you have for someone who's searching and what to look for?
I have like 6 or 7 things that I think are really important questions. The one I put at the first is ask if they have primary care nursing. Many hospices send different nurses every time. And how can you develop a bond or even get a consistency of care and approach? Yes, there are weekly team meetings. Yes, your information is shared and discussed. But hospice is more than just medical care. And if you have the same nurse, the same home health aide for bathing, and the same social worker, you can develop a rapport and a bond with that person, a comfort that you don't necessarily have. No, I'll even take the necessarily out. A comfort that you don't have if you have a stranger every time for every visit.
That's such a good point, because so much of what happens in hospice relies on this relationship with the hospice staff who are coming in to bring care and developing trust and being able to ask the questions you need to ask and feeling safe with the nurses and the home health aides who are there. And if you see a different person for every visit, you don't get a chance to develop that deep relationship. And that is really where the amazing things happen in hospice. It's through the closeness and the relationship that develops.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing that I think you should talk about is inpatient services. A lot of hospices have what I'm going to call a hospice house. And what most of us think a hospice house is that our loved one can go there, kind of like a nursing home, but a special place just for end-of-life situations. And so we think, oh, we've got all the support and guidance, and dad will be in this place, and it'll be wonderful. Because of Medicare guidelines and how so many hospice houses have set themselves up, is you can only be there 5 to 7 days. And most people don't know that. And so you take dad in and dad doesn't die in 7 days. So then dad either has to come back home or go to a nursing facility. There are some hospice houses that will take individual private pay and that you can stay after your Medicare inpatient days are up. But a lot of them don't. And so that's the question you've got to ask also. Can I private pay if I need to?
That's a very good question. And recognizing it's awfully disruptive if you take your loved one to an inpatient facility for 1 week and then have to move them again to another place. So definitely respite care is really important and it can really help families. And sometimes that 1 week can make a big difference in families getting rest they need in order to keep taking care of their loved one at home. So I don't have anything negative to say about getting the respite care, but to remember ahead and plan for the long term that if you put your loved one in, you'll very likely have to just bring them out again. And is that a disruption that you're willing to deal with?
Huge disruption. And I know many, many families that are confused and aren't understanding the protocol for using the inpatient services.
Yeah. I wanted to just mention about having the same nurse, that it's important that you have a good rapport with whoever your team is for care on a hospice, and that people can ask to switch to someone else if they find they for some reason just don't connect with the staff that they're seeing.
Very good point. My guess is that most of the time you're just going to fall in love with your hospice nurse and social worker and home health aide. You will love them. They are kind and gentle and well-trained. But every so often, there's a personality clash. And of course, go to the supervisor and say, this just isn't working.
Yeah. And then up back to your second point about the inpatient hospice, families definitely need to know what's available and what it would really consist of, because so many people don't understand that the burden will be on the family to provide 24/7 care when they're at home. And families have to have addressed that and know in advance that they're able to provide that, that they have enough support and help to be able to do that.
Right. Because I think a lot of people think, well, this, you know, we're going to have staff, hospice staff to be there 24/7. And that isn't the case. It is visits. So that leads me to my next area that I think is important, and that you're going to ask, how often is the nurse going to visit? How often is the home health aide going to visit? And how often is the social worker going to visit? My guidelines for that is, if you think the person had, if hospice thinks the person has months to live, then they should be visited once a week. If they think a person has weeks to live and labor has begun, then they can visit two or three times a week, depending upon the situation. If death is within what you would assume, guess, because it's all guesswork, if you think it, the person has days to hours, then I say they visit every single day. You have to ask what those visits are. And if someone says we visit once a month, then I would say you probably really aren't appropriate for hospice at this time. If someone is within 6 months of dying, which is the criteria for hospice, then they need to be visited every week to get that preparation and that education, that bonding. All of that takes one-on-one. How long do they stay when they come? I think that's also an important question, because if they're in and out in 15, 20 minutes, then that's not long enough. I see an average visit as 45 to 90 minutes, depending upon the situation. Not that you're going to sit there and look at your watch to see how long it is, but you're going to talk and teach and listen. And you can't do that in 25 or 30 minutes.
And Barbara, does that depend somewhat on the caseload that each nurse is carrying at the time? Is that a good question to ask about how many patients in general do nurses carry? Because they may be making short visits because they have so many people they're trying to see in one day.
Very good point. Because if they say they've got a caseload of 20, 25, then that nurse is stressed. She is stretched. That's the word I want. She is stretched thin for time. So it's a very important question.
I know when I had hospice care for my mom at the very end of her life, the hospice nurse was exactly that word, stretched. And I felt sorry for her. She was so busy. And when she did come, she came so late. And I knew she was rushing around all day. I didn't feel so much like I needed the nurse in terms of understanding hospice or what to do for my mom. And, my mom was entitled to have the visit from the nurse. And, a few times she canceled, she couldn't come, she couldn't get there because she had too many patients and couldn't do it. I realized like this is a big problem, and we didn't have a choice of hospice in our community, so this was the only hospice available. But I realized, I wonder how often it happens. The hospice has promised more visits, but the nurse physically can't do it.
Yeah. And so that's why asking what your staffing ratio is and how many patients and how long do you think they expect to stay. I also, and this is probably old-fashioned, Barbara, what I would love to see and am not seeing, but ask if they try to be there at the moment of death. In my mind, that's the goal. The patient's death is the goal. And for that goal, you need to have guidance and support, so for the family. And yet, I will say, today, most people die at home alone without hospice support. And you also want to ask about If no one's there when mom dies, what do I do? Who do I call? What's going to happen? And you want from a hospice that says, well, we're going to try to be there when mom is dying. And if we're not, call us and someone will come and stay with you and guide you and talk to you. You know, there's no 10-minute death pronouncement calls, and yet that happens a lot. So following the death, that family needs as much support and guidance as they did before the death. And you want your hospice to be able to give you that hour, hour and a half following the death, mm-hmm. not 10 minutes.
I agree with old fashioned, Barbara. And that's my old fashioned side too. But those last hours and moments before a death are sometimes, on the one hand, the most beautiful moments, but also the most stressful for a family. And when I've seen some family members panic a little bit and feel like, oh no, mom's having trouble breathing, I think I need to call 911, and they need guidance and they need someone with them to help explain the process and just help walk them through it so that they can feel more comfortable, but also just be there and be present for their loved one rather than being anxious and afraid.
Exactly. I mean, that's, I think, really, really important. The other question is, you want to ask, how often does the social worker visit? How often does the chaplain visit? Medicare requires that the social worker visits once, but oftentimes it's scheduled so that the person dies before the social worker ever gets there. So you need to have that social worker up front. And what I like, but doesn't happen very often, is to have the primary care nurse and the social worker make the first initial visit. And that's your team. And you know, when they walk in the door, this is my team who's going to support and guide me. And then you want to know, what about the chaplain? Do I have to have a chaplain? Because a lot of people think, well, you know, this is going to be religious based, and it's not. Chaplains are compassionate. They are knowledgeable. They aren't there to preach. They aren't there to talk religion. Dying is a sacred experience, and the chaplain can enhance that sacredness just sometimes by being there so you're not alone.
Yeah, so very true. And I think that some hospices might skimp a little bit on in those areas. And when we look at people who are stretched, it might be the social worker and the chaplain, because they may only have one who are trying to see all of the patients that the hospice is covering. And so that's definitely a good question to ask. And I love your idea of having a joint visit with the primary care nurse and the social worker. It's efficient and effective, but it really reinforces to the family that this is a team of people taking care of you who work together, who get along together. They even drive together sometimes and make these visits. And also then those two staff members have asked all the same questions and heard all the same information, and they don't have to go out and once again ask the very same things of the patient and the family. They've heard it together.
I love the idea. When I was running a hospice, that's what I did. They have an admissions nurse generally come, and then the next visit, whether it's next day or a week later, then you meet your primary care nurse. And I don't like that setup, because what happens is the family and the caregivers are scared. They're nervous about what's going on and what's going to happen. And the first professional that walks in the door, it's like baby duck bonding, you know, it's, oh, my person is here. And then that person, after spending an hour getting acquainted, says, well, now next week, you'll meet your primary care nurse. And it's like, what? You're my one. I saw you first. And so it can be really confusing. And it hinders the openness and the comfort level that you want to create with your families.
Mm. That's such a good point. And I've had frustrations about that with hospices I've worked with for a long time who are, in their minds, it's expedient for them to do that, to have the admissions nurse, but they're not really thinking about what's best for the patient and the caregivers.
You know, we're guests in their home, and we have to remember that. It is a personal experience, and we who work in the area, it's a business for us. And so business-wise, hey, I need an intake nurse, and I need the primary, and there are going to be different because I need to schedule. And what I want agencies, and when you're shopping for your hospice, you want to get the feel that you're more important than the financial organization of the company that you're looking to get involved with.
Mm-hmm. And this might be a question that you were already going to address, but when we're talking about the staffing, I mean, I have a bias toward the physicians who are involved in hospice as a physician, but it seems to me that it's really important to know who's your medical director? What kind of doctor? Is it someone trained in hospice? Because I found out this hospice that my mom was receiving care from, their medical director didn't even live in the same town where we lived. It was someone who they were in contact with by telephone to get orders. They had to call this person to try to get orders for medication, and he wasn't available and didn't have a backup person. Like, I was just shocked. I have never heard of such a thing. A physician who didn't even live in the same town, therefore obviously never actually visited the patients or met a patient face to face.
Wow. Wow. That just is unsettling to hear that. So it's an excellent question. Tell me about your medical director.
Yeah. And, you know, not to overemphasize the importance, because the medical director may make one visit to the patient, but as part of the team and as the person who's going to okay the orders, like, it just, to me, it's not a whole team if you haven't included that physician in the IDT and in the staffing of the patient.
Oh, it's hard for me to imagine at a team meeting not to have your medical director. I mean, that's not hospice. It's not hospice. Another thing in looking at hospices, don't get concerned about what you don't need. You know, you're going to hear, oh, we've got physical therapy, we've got occupational therapists, we've got speech therapists, we've got, you know, all these ancillary, you're probably not going to need them. They aren't really necessary. We're dealing with helping families and a person live until they're not. And we aren't trying to fix them because it's been determined medically that we can't fix this person. And so we want to give them the best quality dying experience. That might sound a little cold, but really, dying is not a medical event. It is an emotional, it is a spiritual event. And so you want to really get the emotional component that you're going to have with this agency, not the business component.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, though that makes so much sense. And maybe sometimes there are bells and whistles that are added on to as part of marketing, but you know, to make the hospice sound better. But in truth, those may be things that you'll never utilize and don't really need.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I think is confusing for hospice is patients that have dementia as their only diagnosis. Dementia doesn't play by the rules, and you've got to really ask questions about the hospice and how they work with dementia. Oftentimes, hospice will bring you on and say, well, we'll visit once a month, and then we reevaluate because Medicare requires you to reevaluate. And after so many days, if the decline isn't there, then they're going to discharge you, and you're then left to your own devices. And so you really want to be careful with dementia because way too often the hospice will bring you on and then death won't come when everyone expects. So I look with that, with dementia, I look at eating. I don't look at their socialization. I don't look at their sleeping. I look at their eating, because if you don't eat, you don't live. And so if they're choking, holding food in their mouth, having trouble swallowing, then they're probably not getting enough calories to maintain their body. And that means death will come, and then they will be very appropriate for hospice.
And I wanted to ask, Barbara, when a patient does get discharged from hospice, if there's a waiting period before they can come back on hospice again?
Do you know? I don't know, because I don't follow the regs. With end of life. But I was talking to someone just recently, and they have been on and off hospice like 3 times. And I don't know how that works, but I hear comments and stories of how devastated it is for the caregiver who has had all these services and medications paid for, medical equipment, nursing, social work, home bathing. And then to have that rug pulled out from underneath them, and now they're back alone. So what I strongly believe, and you can ask as you're asking about the services, is to have, if the hospice determines, excuse me, if the hospice determines that, the patient is no longer appropriate for hospice, then I want to see a social work visit to that home and all kinds of preparation of changing care, of giving that family and that caregiver options, what's out there in the community, and to help them make that transition instead of just saying, we can't do it.
It would be terrible to just suddenly be dropped like that and lose the services that you've come to depend on for 6 months or so.
Yes, yes. One of the other things that I think is important to ask is, when do you make your initial visit? You know, I had an experience with a hospice recently, and it was over Labor Day, and it's, well, yeah, we can't come and make your assessment visit, your initial visit, because it's the weekend and then it's Labor Day. And no, time is our enemy. And if I get a hospice referral within 24 hours, maybe 48, but that's stretching it, Monday through Monday, you know, the whole week, that initial visit needs to be made because time is the enemy.
So true. That's a great question to ask. When will our first visit happen, and how soon can you come? Because for some patients are only going to be on hospice for a week or 10 days, and waiting for the visits to begin is actually detrimental.
It is. So those that's my list of questions that I think people need to ask when they're shopping. And I strongly recommend that if you've got a person in your life that has a life-threatening illness, or that is has an illness that the physicians are trying very, very hard to fix, and you're seeing not so much progress, that's the time to do your information run. Not when you have the emergency of, oh my God, I'm drowning and I don't know what to do. Do your homework before you need it. So if you have a diagnosis with a life-threatening illness, before anything else, that's one of the things that you need to get in place. Then put the information on the shelf and you'll know when you need it, where it is.
And I know, Barbara, sometimes discharge planners from hospitals will recommend a hospice, but there may be more hospices in your community than are recommended to you, which is why it look beyond just the one hospice someone told you about, because you have no idea what else might be out there and the types of services or the quality that could be available to you might be missing out on if you just take the first recommendation that comes.
Well, and most hospitals today have their own home health care agency. They have their own hospice. But that doesn't mean it's the best one for you. And so absolutely, just because the hospital suggests, well, we'll hook you up, we'll get an initial assessment out there with our hospice. Hopefully you've done your homework beforehand and you go, you know, I did some research and I want you to make the contact with this hospice. You know, have the name you want. And also, there's nothing wrong with setting up an appointment with a hospice that you're researching and going in and have a face-to-face, look at their office, sit down, look at their people, you know, and how do they interact with me? When you do this early, you've got the time to really take everything into consideration, where if you don't, then you're drowning and you take the first rope someone throws to you.
That's so true. So true. There isn't time to do the research in the moment of a crisis. And Barbara, I had another question I wanted to ask you about. Well, a couple of things. One was, this all comes from my personal experience with this hospice for my mom, but a relationship with a pharmacy, because the hospice that I worked with, my mom needed some medication in the middle of the night. they said, oh, no, the hospice we work, the pharmacy we work with closes at 6 p.m. and we can't get a prescription for you until tomorrow when they open again. And for me, that was a really crucial element that, you know, is there a 24-hour pharmacy in the community and does the hospice work with them? And they wouldn't go to a different pharmacy because they had a contract with this particular pharmacy. And I was just curious if that's worth asking about.
Oh, very definitely worth asking. And that's something we don't think about. You know, we don't think about medications till we need it. And so we hear, well, hospice pays for medications that are related to the life-threatening illness. And so we assume that the hospice has everything set in place so that 24/7 medication is available. That's just awful. I mean, how do you run a hospice like that?
Yeah. I mean, granted, we were in a smaller, more rural community. So there, you know, but it still seemed to me like you have to know we have a relationship with a hospital pharmacy or there has to be a way and you have to have taken care of that to be able to get medication when a patient needs it in the night. And then the other thing that came up for me was bereavement support, because I think that can vary a lot from one hospice to another, how much bereavement support they offer, whether it's that they send you a form letter every couple of months or if they have better services available.
So often they'll send you a sympathy card within the first week and then you don't hear from them again for 6 months and you get a letter saying we're having a bereavement group. And really when you're grieving, all that stuff's going to go into the waste paper basket. You need someone to come to your door, to call and say, I want to come over, and have that social worker, or if you have a bereavement counselor, do a face-to-face. And I like to have the volunteers brought in and develop a relationship with the family, then have the volunteer take the family member to the bereavement group, because part of grieving is I don't have the energy to leave my house, let alone go sit with a group of people. And so if I have a relationship with a hospice volunteer and that relationship, that volunteer says, we'll go together, you're going to get more people at your bereavement group.
That's so true. And, you know, for some reason, like the Medicare requirements are that every hospice have a bereavement program, but it could be anything. It could be the sympathy card and a form letter, all the way to weekly support groups that take place in the hospice office where people are welcome to come. So there's a very big difference in what hospices offer in that area.
And, you know, as caregivers, we're so caught up in taking care of our special person that we aren't really thinking about ourselves and what's going to happen to us when our special person is gone. That's not where our focus is at the time. And so I think that's why the personal contact afterwards is so important, because the caregiver hasn't really even thought about it or doesn't have the energy to think beyond for support for themselves. So it has to be the hospice that takes the initiative to get them the support and really get them to their groups, because the group support is fabulous if it's a good one. But in grief, we don't have the energy.
Yeah, so true. Well, and I would say, Barbara, when we record these conversations about hospice, we're recording them for people, lay people in the community who don't know much about hospice and have no experience, who need information. But if I were running a hospice, I would listen to this interview and think, we should make sure our brochure spells out certain things that are concerns that people who listen to Barbara are going to ask these questions. And we should make sure our website, our brochure tells people what we do offer and that we do have these services available so that they can easily find that information out when they're doing their research and trying to find the best hospice.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can always start with your Google and read the, you know, go through the websites of all the different hospices. But then I think you need either a personal phone call where you hear a human voice and can directly answer your questions, and then maybe consider a physical drop into their office. And you can do all that before you need them. Then you have the time. When it gets to dad's being discharged from the hospital and they've said, you know, we can't fix him, we'll get you a hospice referral, that's really too late. It's like the door has shut on the barn and all animals are out.
Yes.
So, do your homework ahead of time. Really important.
And any good hospice should not mind that you call them and ask questions or even ask if you could meet with someone, because that is actually part of their role, really, is educating the community and being a resource for people in the community.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And well, that's you and I, Barbara. We are continuing that role as just as trying to be a resource. And I know a lot of our listeners already know about hospice, but our goal is really to reach out to people who don't. And so I would encourage people listening to just share our interviews with people who may have questions, who need more information about hospice, because that's really why we're doing this and what we want to share with people, to help people be comfortable and to help them more easily choose to go with hospice to care for their loved ones.
Oh, so important. You know, gather your information. That's as much a responsibility, I think, to gather your information as it is to understand what your medications and your side effects are. Same thing, you know, knowledge reduces fear. Knowledge makes for better care and a better experience.
So that's so well said, Barbara, and so true. And I love that old-fashioned Barbara and old-fashioned Karen show up sometimes for these conversations because, like I said, you and I got to work. We had the privilege of working in hospice in the old days, when things were different and maybe it was easier to do some of the things that we talk about that we think are really important. But we're just trying to keep that alive and trying to remind everyone of the beauty of hospice, what it should be and can be, and how it can be helpful to people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the times that I was a primary nurse for hospice were absolutely life-altering times for me. That's where I learned how people die. You know, that's where I learned what it's like at the moment of death. Because before then, nobody really knew as far as the medical profession. And it was those early years that I want others to know and to experience, because it can be an absolute beautiful, you know, to hear a family say, "Barbara, mother's death was beautiful." Then I know I've done my work, and I want all families to have that experience. And like you said, that's why you and I are doing what we're doing.
Exactly. That's what motivates us. Every time we get together, we come up with something else to share with people. So thank you once again, Barbara, my friend. It's always so wonderful to talk with you.
Oh, you know, it's special. I look forward to it.
And we'll be back in a couple of months and have another conversation. So thank you.
Okay, I'll see you then.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Barbara Carnes. She is my guest every other month on the podcast. So tune in 2 months from now to hear our next episode. We always have great conversations together. And as Barbara said, we've become close friends by just meeting together virtually and talking about hospice and all the aspects of caring for someone at the end of life. If you enjoy this content, please share it with other people who might benefit from listening. And also be sure you have subscribed and left a rating and review wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. That's really helpful in terms of having this podcast shown to people who are searching for this kind of content. And if you're willing and able to make a small financial contribution to help keep this show on the air, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support and find 3 different ways that you can make a small donation. If you join my page on Patreon, you'll receive some bonuses like my monthly end-of-life news update. I'm also now doing a monthly what to watch update, suggesting things that you might like to watch and help support the death positive media that's happening out there. And you'll have access to certain types of merchandise that will come depending on the level at which you support. Also, if you enjoy watching videos, I have a YouTube channel and you can see the videos of all the interviews I do. It's also named End of Life University on YouTube. And I have a second podcast called What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality. You can check that out wherever you happen to listen. They're shorter episodes where I talk a lot about my own spiritual journey, the lessons that I've been learning and what I'm working on. Really every day as I'm trying to grow in consciousness as a spiritual being here on planet Earth. So thanks again for listening today and joining me here. I'll see you again next week with another new interview. And until then, remember, we're here for love and we're also here for grieving. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next. And love each and every moment of your very precious existence. Bye-bye.